I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Change is in the air, and we've got the numbers to prove it on today's show. At a time when tax revenues are declining and city budgets are strained, our first guest has a modest proposal that could produce big dividends for cities. Joe Courtwright is an economist for Impresa Consulting in Portland, Oregon, and his latest work shows how profitable it can be for a city to be greener, smarter, with less poverty. Plus, is Chicago the new New York? We'll speak with Wendy Taylor Nations of the global PR firm Porter Novelli about the numbers showing that Chicago may be a trendsetter in more ways than just national politics. And how do you teach your children about city planning? Plan Edison's Tim Halber will be with us to discuss his new children's book, Where Things Are From Near to Far. Stay with us for today's Smart City right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Everybody wants to live in a city with fewer people below the poverty line, with more transportation options, and with a better educated workforce. But what if by making your city smarter and greener, you can make it richer too? Our guest, Joe Courtwright, is an economist for Impresa Consulting, and he has produced a report called City Dividends that describes the specific economic benefits a city can earn by making small improvements in performance. Joe, explain the concept behind the city dividends. What are you measuring and why?
Well, what city dividends does is look at what gains cities can make from small but achievable improvements in each of three areas: increasing their talent, improving their sustainability, and reducing poverty.
And when you say increasing their talent, what do you mean by talent? How do you define talent?
The measure we use for talent is to look at the percentage of the population that has completed a four-year degree. And that's a good way of benchmarking the relative level of skill and education in a population. And so our calculation of the city dividend looks at what the gain in personal income would be if a metropolitan area increased the percentage of persons with a four-year degree by one percentage point.
How do you know what that would be? How do you make that calculation?
We know that education is one of the most powerful explainers of how well economies succeed. Better educated areas have higher incomes. And we know that statistically, across the 50 large metropolitan areas in the United States, a 1 percentage point improvement in college attainment is associated with about a $760 higher level of per capita income for the entire metropolitan area.
And so you can look at what that 1 percentage point increase would be and calculate the number of people, the additional number of people with a college degree, and then put a dollar figure on that.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's when the education level improves by about that amount, what would be the gain associated with the total level of personal income in the metropolitan area?
We talk so much about education, and everybody thinks, you know, their K-12 system is broken. It seems today that fewer people are going to college. So I'm wondering, is 1 percentage point, is that, it doesn't sound like much, but is that a hard gain to make for most cities?
If you look at the variation across metropolitan areas, you get a sense of what's achievable and what isn't. The best educated metropolitan areas in the United States have about 40% of their population or slightly more with that four-year level of educational attainment. And the least well-educated of the large metropolitan areas have a little bit less than 20% of their population with a four-year degree. So it's very feasible to imagine for most metropolitan areas that they could get about a 1% increase, which is why we use that as a threshold for measuring this improvement.
I've heard you make the point, and I just want to give you a chance to make it here, that even though college attainment, four-year college attainment, is the point at which you are measuring, college attainment doesn't rise without everything coming before it rising. So more people are graduating from high school, more people are acquiring two-year degrees, etc.
Right. And what we're really measuring is a whole distribution of skills or education in the population. We're not just talking about moving people who are just short of a four-year degree past getting a four-year degree. We're talking about shifting the entire distribution of educational attainment to make the whole population better educated. But the way we measure it, just for simplicity, is to talk about where that fraction of the population who've completed the four-year degree are. But it's really about improving all along the educational spectrum.
Joe, I've also heard you make the point that the best predictor of a city's success is the percent of college-educated people in its population. True?
Yeah, we can statistically explain about two-thirds of the variation in per capita income across metropolitan areas just by knowing what fraction of the adults have completed a four-year degree.
What's the other third?
Oh, the other third is all the other factors that influence an economy, the composition of its industrial base and the productivity of its workers and cost factors and so on.
So if we were able to achieve this 1 percentage point gain in college attainment in the top 50 metro areas, or the top 51 metro areas, those metro areas with a million or more people, what value does that have to the nation?
Well, in the aggregate, a 1% increase for the top 50 metropolitan areas would produce a total gain annually of about $124 billion a year.
Okay, so that's significant.
Absolutely.
Let's go to the next dividend you described, and you called it an improvement in sustainability. Gosh, I can think of 1,000 things that might be. Tell me what you mean by an improvement in sustainability.
Well, the thing we focus on with the sustainability or the green dividend is driving. We know that driving is expensive, it costs people money, and that the more driving that people in a metropolitan area do, the more they of their household budgets they end up spending on transportation. So what we've done is compute how much people would save if they could reduce the amount of driving that they do by 1 mile per person per day.
This seems achievable. Tell me the range of vehicle miles traveled per day, per person across the top 50 metro areas. I mean, what's the spread look like?
The typical metropolitan area drives about 25 miles per person per day. The most compact and best transit-served metropolitan areas, it's under 20 miles per person per day. And then the most sprawling areas, it's like 35 to 40 miles per person per day.
That's actually a bit of a tighter spread than I imagined. And it's interesting to me when cities talk about sustainability or green initiatives, I rarely hear cities talk about driving, and yet every day, urban leaders, city hall, there are decisions being made about land use, about zoning, and about transportation. So it seems to me that this would sort of be front and center in a set of green or sustainability initiatives. Why do you think it's not?
You know, I think it's something that takes a while. You don't necessarily see immediate changes or returns in it. And there are, as you pointed out, there are a lot of small decisions that when added together really influence how much driving goes on in a metropolitan area. So it's about the patterns of land use as well as investments in transit and how walkable and bikeable a community is. So there aren't any silver bullets there. It takes a lot of actions over a long period of time to really move that number.
You live in Portland, and I know that you bike a lot of places, and I know also that you love your cars. So tell me what it is about Portland that makes you hop on a bike, take a bike, and head off to your destination.
Part of it is that there's a fairly compact pattern of land uses. Part of it is that the city has done things with bike lanes and with signing. And the other thing is there are a lot of people who bicycle here. So there really is strength and safety in numbers. And if you live in a community where a lot of people are cycling, then it's not as scary, and it's more likely that those people who are driving cars are used to having bikes on the road with them, and some of those people who are driving cars also ride their bike part of the time. So it's a learning phenomenon, And, you know, that's really what's happened in Portland over the last 7 or 8 years, is there's been a dramatic increase in cycling, in part because people see that it is a viable way of getting around, and it's not something that's strange or unusual.
I'm curious, you live in a residential neighborhood in Portland. Do you walk anywhere?
Yeah, actually, we have a grocery store, a couple of grocery stores that are a little over a quarter mile away from our house, so we can walk to those. In fact, a couple of days ago, my daughter and I walked to the store. Not unusual. And there are restaurants and coffee shops that we can walk to. And depending on the weather and my inclination, I'll walk or bicycle. Or if it's raining like crazy and I have to get a lot of stuff, I'll take the car.
I didn't ask you what the reduction in 1 mile per day per person is worth to the nation if, again, we did it in the top 51 metro areas that have a million or more people. What is that worth to the nation annually?
If you look at those 51 large metropolitan areas and they were all to reduce the amount of driving they do by 1 mile per person per day, that would produce a savings of about $29 billion a year for the consumers in those large metropolitan areas.
And how do you calculate those savings?
We basically look at the cost of operating a vehicle, which includes both the gasoline and maintenance, but the capital cost as well. And that works out to about 40 cents a mile. So every mile that we save saves consumers about 40 cents.
And so that would be money. It's not a savings to the government. It's actually savings to people in a community, and then that money is available to be essentially recycled through the local economy for different purposes other than foreign oil or cars made outside the community. Is that essentially the calculation you're making?
Exactly right. So every dollar that you don't spend on car payments and gasoline is money that you can spend on other things. And for the most part, those kinds of expenditures are much more likely to go to local businesses than to car companies or oil companies.
Okay, third dividend is the opportunity dividend, which is a 1 percentage point reduction in poverty. It seems to me like poverty has almost fallen off the American agenda, even to some extent the urban policy agenda. What do you make of that? Maybe you think my sense of it is wrong.
Well, poverty is a big driver of public service expenses, the cost of the public sector. So chiefly we spend a lot of money on that section of the population that can't get its own income. You know, we're talking about, in a typical metropolitan area, 12 or 13% of the population. So part of it is it's not everybody. It's really just a segment of the population that's not necessarily the most vocal or well covered in the media.
You and I have talked about a measure that puts people who are living below the poverty rate in a better position to succeed, giving them more access to jobs and to education. And it has to do with where they live. You call it a measure of economic integration. Can you explain why you think having communities that are economically integrated strengthens a community?
Sure. Well, one of the really pernicious problems associated with poverty is really concentrated poverty. If everybody in your neighborhood is poor, that intensifies all of the problems associated with poverty. You know, you can think about crime, you can think about the quality of schools. In an economic sense, you can think about the kind of social networks that are important to finding and keeping jobs. And people who live in neighborhoods where everybody is poor are just not going to have the kind of opportunities they do in places where there's a more of a mixing of the population. And so the measure of economic integration that we use looks at the extent to which lower income people live in relatively close proximity to middle and upper income people. And in most metropolitan areas in the United States, low-income people live close to other low-income people. And our measure of economic integration measures the extent to which neighborhoods have a better mixing. And there's considerable variation across the large metropolitan areas in the United States.
And that variation exists, I'm sure, in some cases for historical purposes. That doesn't justify it, but it may explain it. It probably exists in some cases because of landscape or natural barriers. Are there ways to mitigate, or are there ways to overcome economic segregation?
we know that one of the leading causes of economic segregation has been suburbanization, and particularly in places where you have lots of municipalities in the suburbs, and those municipalities zone land strictly for single-family or large-lot single-family development. If you have an entire municipality that's zoned for, say, two-acre minimum lot sizes, then it's harder for low- and moderate-income people to live in those communities. And in those cases where it's very sprawling and you have a lot of low-density development, you tend to have a much wider separation of higher-income and lower-income people, which works to the disadvantage of lower-income people in terms of, you know, physical access to job opportunities, but then also these kinds of social networks that are so important to finding and keeping jobs.
It's interesting when you talk about the percentage of people who are living below the poverty line, and you talk about 12%, which I think is the national average. I know it's much higher in some urban areas, and yet, if you think, well, okay, so you've got 12% of the people to spread across the entire landscape, giving you 88% of the people not living in those circumstances, you would think that economic integration wouldn't be that big of a challenge.
Well, absolutely. And we're seeing that in a number of metropolitan areas where, you know, you see redevelopment of close-in neighborhoods, and you get a different population mix than you have had historically in a lot of places.
What is it worth to the U.S., once again, if we could achieve this opportunity dividend by reducing poverty one percentage point in each of the top 51 metro areas in the U.S.?
When we look at that idea of reducing the poverty rate, which is typically about 12%, by one percentage point for an entire metropolitan area, and if you could do that for each of the large metropolitan areas, it would reduce the cost of anti-poverty programs, things like welfare, food stamps, Medicaid, by about $13 billion a year.
In that calculation, you have not included things like subsidized housing, extra social service costs, extra cost of policing, anything like that. You've simply said these are the direct payments we're making to people in poverty. These payments would be eliminated if people were earning above the poverty line.
Right. And that's based on the relationship that we see across metropolitan areas in terms of, you know, some areas that have larger poor populations spend that much more. So that's the experience we observe for just those expenditures across metropolitan areas.
Now, I want to clarify, and you've said this repeatedly, but just to make the point, Joe, these are metro numbers. They're not city numbers.
Right. This is for the whole metropolitan area, for all the metropolitan areas with a million or more population in the U.S., and there are 51 of those.
And why did you figure the city dividends for entire metro areas rather than cities?
Well, we think that metropolitan areas are the right unit of analysis for understanding how economies work, that cities and suburbs really function in a very interdependent way. And so to understand what the opportunity is and to accurately calculate those costs, we think you have to look at the whole metropolitan area.
So we can give our listeners an idea of what this really means at a local level. I want to just pick three communities, three metro areas, and I want you to tell me what each of the city dividends, the talent dividend, the green dividend, and the opportunity dividend would be worth to that community. Let's take Miami. What are the numbers there?
Well, for Miami, the one percentage point improvement in the college attainment rate would work out to a little over $4 billion a year for that whole metropolitan area.
Wow. What about the green dividend?
Reducing the amount of driving by about 1 mile per person per day is about $700 million a year.
And opportunity dividend, reduction in poverty by one percentage point?
In Miami, that would be almost $400 million a year.
So the total is, do the math.
The total is a little over $5 billion for Miami if they work on all three of those. Talent is where the really big gains are.
But those other two are certainly serious money. Put that number in perspective for me. I don't know the Miami economy terribly well, but I know you know Oregon very well. Tell me, what business would have a payroll equal to the gains the city dividends would create for Miami?
if you think about a $4 billion payroll, that in a metropolitan area the size of Miami would be equal to, you know, any of the largest manufacturing sectors. I mean, if you were talking about it in economic development terms, you know, that would be a major coup. There's probably no biotechnology industry anywhere in the United States that has a $4 billion annual payroll.
The whole industry?
Yeah.
Okay, substantial. We'll have more from our interview with Joe Courtwright in a moment, but first, we have the latest in the world of urban planning and design from Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
More than 2 million people filed into Washington, D.C. earlier this week to witness the inauguration of President Barack Obama. Some have called it the largest public gathering in American history, and it's sure to stand out as one of the country's most historic inaugurations. The record crowds also showed up in Washington, D.C.'s metro stations, clogging and overwhelming public transit in and around the city. According to an article from the Wall Street Journal, more than 550,000 riders had entered the system by noon on Inauguration Day. Lines to enter stations had riders waiting up to and over an hour just to get in, and numerous sources reported incredibly packed trains and buses throughout the day. DC's Metro marked its highest day of ridership ever Monday before the inauguration with more than 700,000 riders, a figure that was then surpassed the next day, with Metro officials estimating more than 1 million passengers riding on Inauguration Day. Though obviously not the typical day for DC's Metro, the increased ridership may be seen as a sign that Americans are warming up to the idea of public transit. And they may be, but as far as the nation's economic stimulus is concerned, transit is still a far second place to driving. The Wall Street Journal reports that road funding outnumbers public transit funding 3-1 in Congress's draft economic stimulus package. The package proposes about $43 billion to fund road, transit, and airport projects in the country, less than the $53 billion proposed by the House Transportation Committee, and almost one half of the $85 billion many in Congress were expecting. $30 billion of the proposed $43 billion has been set aside for highway projects, angering many transit advocates who had hoped for a greater investment. But the stimulus package is not yet final, and Congress members can surely expect to hear from transit lobbyists as the bill moves forward. And meanwhile, in an unlikely role reversal, redevelopment plans in suburban Minneapolis have a Walmart store screaming, "Not in my backyard." The city of Eden Prairie, Minnesota has been drafting plans for the creation of a pedestrian-oriented traditional downtown, a redevelopment plan that would drive a new main street through the parking lot of the town's Walmart. According to a recent article from the Minneapolis St. Paul Star Tribune, officials in Eden Prairie have surveyed residents about what they'd like to see in their town, and an overwhelming majority has called for a more diverse, compact, and active downtown area. Plans for the redevelopment have been sent off for regional approval, which has complicated Walmart's plans to expand. But with residents clamoring for a more compact downtown lifestyle, city officials are hoping Walmart will compromise to allow the development and downsize its own footprint. For Plan Edison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of PlanEdison.com. Coming up after the break, we'll have more from Joe Courtwright about his study, City Dividends. Plus, we'll hear from Wendy Taylor Nations of the firm Porter Novelli about the values coming out of Chicago. You're listening to Smart City. And a special welcome to our podcast listeners. You've heard us talk about our social networking site, My City, and the community there has been booming. Hundreds of listeners, just like you, have joined the site and are talking and collaborating on all the issues that mean the most to people who love cities. Want to join? Send us an email to our producer, Scotty, at smartcityradio.com, and he'll get you signed up. I look forward to seeing you online. And now, back to the show. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Let's get back to my interview with Joe Courtwright of Impresa Consulting. We were talking about how metro areas that make small improvements in performance can reap large economic rewards, what he calls the city dividends. Before the break, he told us that Miami's city dividend is a little more than $5 billion. I asked him, what's the benefit for a city like Memphis?
Well, for Memphis, the talent dividend would work out to about $1 billion a year in additional personal income from a 1 percentage point improvement in the college attainment rate. The green dividend is about a $200 million gain, and the opportunity dividend there is about a $100 million gain.
And so the total is?
Total is about $1.3 billion.
$1.3 billion. Do you have any estimate? I know the biggest employer in Memphis, of course, is FedEx. Do you have any idea what FedEx's payroll would be, or could you estimate it? I'm kind of curious to compare it to that city dividends number.
I don't know the FedEx payroll, but it's probably a little less than that $1 billion figure.
So basically, Memphis could say, okay, we can get a 1 percentage point gain in college attainment in Memphis, or we could attract another FedEx employing that many people.
Those two things would be about in the same ballpark.
Wow. And one would probably be highly unachievable. Okay, let's take one more city, Chicago.
Okay.
Metro area, Chicago. Tell me what the talent, the green, and the opportunity dividend would be for Chicago.
Yeah, a 1 percentage point improvement in the college attainment rate in the Chicago metro area would work out to about a $7 billion gain in total personal income. Reducing driving by about 1 mile per person per day would produce a gain of about $1.6 billion in the Chicago region. And the opportunity dividend gain there would be a little over $700 million. So the total for those three would be around $10 billion gain.
Those are extraordinary numbers. And they really are when you think about them. It's interesting, though. I think in some ways putting these numbers out there for urban leaders, community leaders, citizens to think about it challenges sort of conventional wisdom around economic development or the siloed way in which we normally approach things in communities. So talent, that's up to you educators. Green, oh, that's just a bunch of individual decisions. Nobody has anything to do with that. We can't control how many, you know, miles people drive. And poverty, throw up our hands. We don't know what to do about poverty. I mean, it seems that there's some bridge building to be done.
Yeah, as I said, there aren't any silver bullets in any of these three areas. And it really takes concerted action across a series of sectors and policies in order to achieve these gains. But if you can do that, the gains themselves are very substantial, which suggests there are really good reasons why folks ought to focus on these three items.
Joe, I want to shift gears a minute and ask you about the economic stimulus package, and it's coming down very, very fast. I think the horse is out of the barn on this one. But if you were whispering in the president's ear, what would you tell him to invest in?
You should look for two things. One would be, you know, obviously you have to do stuff quickly. This recession is unfolding day by day, and we have to do something to counteract the psychology of the marketplace right now. That said, I think I would look for opportunities to do things that are transformative and that move us in the right direction. And if you think about that green dividend, the kind of investments in sustainability that give people a different set of options that enable them to, for example, save money by driving less. So I think investments in transit, investments in walkability, and then also investments in energy conservation generally, home weatherization and retrofitting public buildings, those pay long-term gains and help us be more sustainable. So those would be the kinds of things that I'd focus on. And they also create lots of jobs.
Yeah. Is there a way to spend the stimulus to advance this idea of the talent dividend?
There is, and probably the most important thing the federal government can do there is help states and localities avoid layoffs in the public school system. It makes very little sense to try and create jobs by hiring construction workers at the same time you're laying off teachers and police and firemen. So the the low-hanging fruit from the stimulus there is just stopping the loss in the state and local governments, because state and local governments, unlike the federal government, can't deficit spend, and they are the ones who do the lion's share of the financial support for education in the United States. So hopefully the stimulus package will help state and local governments keep teachers and other educators and public employees on the job.
You live in Portland, Oregon. How is Portland holding up in the downturn?
We're experiencing the downturn really the same as is everyone else. Unemployment rates are up pretty sharply. From a public finance standpoint, we're a little bit better off than other places because we don't have a sales tax, because consumer spending has dropped so precipitously in this recession. States that rely heavily on sales taxes have been the hardest hit, although we'll see the impact with a little bit of a lag because we depend on the income tax and on capital gains more than the typical state. So as all of those losses in stock markets and decline in housing value sort of ripple through the tax system, we'll see declines a little bit later than some other states.
That brings up a question that I have. If you were to design the tax structure that would hold up the best in a recession, what would it look like?
You know, actually, ironically, property taxes are holding up pretty well in our state, but that's a fluke due to the way we do assessments. In some states, the property taxes are declining precipitously because they go down with property values. We have a bit of a disconnect in that system. So, yeah, I'm not sure there's a perfect answer to that, because every recession is a little bit different. Every state is a little bit different. And I don't know that you can really fully insulate yourself from the effects of recessions.
You have a new mayor, Sam Adams. He has just been sworn into office. What do you expect from the new mayor?
Oh, Sam is a very energetic and aggressive mayor, and he's a bundle of energy, and I know he'll be involved in a broad series of issues. He's very interested in improving the city schools, dealing with transportation issues, and improving the sustainability of our city going forward. So I'm sure he'll be active in all three of those areas.
Joe, it is always a pleasure to have you on Smart City. Thanks so much for being our guest.
My pleasure, Carol.
Joe Courtwright is an economist for Impresa Consulting, and he joined us from his home in Portland, Oregon. His latest work, conducted with CEOs for cities, is called City Dividends. We have a link to the full report on our website, smartcityradio.com. Our next guest, Wendy Taylor Nations, is the managing director of the Chicago office of Porter Novelli. Porter Novelli is a global public relations firm that recently released an annual study about American attitudes and behaviors. Wendy joined us in our office to tell us about the results of that survey and how President Obama's hometown of Chicago may be leading the nation in more ways than one. Wendy, each year Porter Novelli surveys Americans on their attitudes and behaviors. Did you find anything this year that looked like a new trend?
We certainly did. Our data showed that consumers very much were focusing on values and their community. That is a trend that we have been measuring for the last 3 years or so, but it spiked this year, and we really saw the link as to the Obama campaign.
Now, when you say values and community, tell me more. What are you talking about?
Values in, I want to be a part of a larger city, a larger region in which I can be a player in making a difference. Not that I have to have a big name or have big money, but that I can make a difference. The trend is that Chicagoans are very much feeling that they have the confidence to make a difference.
So is it the fact that Obama is from the Chicago area, or is it something in the water in Chicago that produces that feeling of, I'm committed, I want to be part of a larger movement?
I think it's a little bit of both. You'll remember that we haven't seen many headlines. When I travel overseas, you still hear either Bang Bang, Al Capone, or Michael Jordan. The Bulls haven't been champions, sadly, for a while.
But they do have Derrick Rose.
They do have Derrick Rose, yes. But there has been that lack of confidence, that taking the second city very seriously. Barack Obama, with his emphasis on Chicago and the way that he very much conducted this campaign, I believe, really gave back this sense of confidence, this, yes, we deserve the Olympics and we're going to get that, that we're much bigger players. We're not just strong Midwesterners. We are citizens of the world in an important way.
I'm interested to hear you refer to the Al Capone because I saw a comment by my colleague Rita Athes, who runs World Business Chicago, recently on the front page of the Tribune. And Rita mentioned that as well. As someone not from Chicago but living here now, that's not something that comes to my mind. But you really believe that attitude is out there internationally?
I do. I've experienced it.
Interesting. So let's come back to the survey itself and the broader things that you found. Were there other trends that the survey revealed that do not have to do with a newfound sense of value and a desire to connect to and through community?
Very much so. The focus and emphasis on healthcare, and not just taking care of yourself, but taking care of others. The whole idea of charity begins at home. It begins in your own family and taking care of those that you love, but also translating into addressing large healthcare issues like cancer, HIV, very much believing that if you have an emphasis on taking care of that and research, that will play out at home. Kind of like an insurance policy. If I give to the American Cancer Society, I'm creating a karmic insurance policy that's going to keep me well.
Knowing what you know from the survey, if you were advising a nonprofit like the American Cancer Society, is that the spin you would put on your message?
I don't think that philanthropy is based on that kind of a message, but I think that people do give based on that feeling. I don't believe, though, that would be a strong external message.
We're talking now about values. We're talking about politics in a way, philanthropy. In this survey, you look at consumer attitudes and behaviors as well.
Yes.
Were there buying habits that showed up that may suggest something new is going on?
Yes. It appears, based on our survey, that this whole idea of this greedy rise of more and more and more has hit a ceiling. And Chicagoans are leading the way in saying, I'm not going to spend all my money on things. I want to invest in my family in a faithful and a very deliberate way. But buying a new car every year, I'm not going to see any value from that. I'm not going to derive any benefit from that. I need to change my behavior based on the economy.
And that's so interesting because obviously we're a consumer culture and a huge part of our economy rests on this idea that we're going to continue to shop. I mean, do you really see something in the survey data that suggests people are going to shop less?
Yes. Chicagoans shop at the Costcos and the Sam's Clubs of the world in a much larger degree than do the coasts.
I blogged about this the other day. I remember when Jimmy Carter asked us to turn our thermostats down to 68, which was, you know, that was 4 degrees less than most people were used to. And instead of putting on the hair shirt and, you know, moaning about turning the thermostats to 68, the fashion industry introduced long skirts, boots, layered looks, leg warmers. They made it fashionable. They had a fashion response to this admonition to sacrifice, right? So we turned sacrifice into fashion. And I'm wondering if there's something going on here now that we're forced to shop less because of the economy, because of our incomes being cut. Are we going to make shopping less a value, a fashion statement or a value statement? Do you pick up any of that in the survey?
Absolutely. Frugal is the new green. One day you've got a $4 gallon of gasoline. The next day it's $2. How can you really make a determination where your dollars are going to go on a day-to-day basis? So you just pull back. Frugal is the new green.
Now, will that have an outsized impact on retailers like Starbucks, which are offering indulgent products, $4 cups of coffee?
I think Starbucks is going to have to figure out how to give consumers what they want in terms of frugality. And I think they're already starting to see that. You see it in their stock price.
Did you find it odd that Chicagoans thought of themselves as trendsetters?
I did. when I looked at the data, I had to look at it again and again, and I went back to beyond the summary of the survey. If you think about it for just a few minutes, I live in downtown Chicago. I walk outside my door, and I'm a minute walk from four different parks. This city is very interested in bringing everybody together as a community. Not only interested, but encouraging. If you look at Lincoln Park, the way that we've brought together the museum campus, all of those are very deliberately designed in order to bring people together.
And you think the bringing people together is a sign of what?
Of a sense of community and a desire to focus on the greater good rather than your own self.
When the survey was released a few weeks ago, you wrote, Barack Obama and other senior Illinois politicians will take the values of the Second City with them to Washington, D.C. Obama's approach to tackling universal challenges in healthcare, energy, and the environment is rooted in a Midwestern, no-nonsense, can-do mindset, and those values will shape American politics in the years to come. With the arrest of Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, you knew I was going to ask you this. Does your statement still stand?
I think it absolutely does. Since that arrest, you look at the social media and the response from people in Chicago and in the Midwest is revulsion, anger, contempt for Governor Blagojevich's behaviors. And I think it's a perfect proof point. We're not going to allow someone who is threatening to reduce Children's Memorial Hospital's funding because a CEO didn't get him a donation fast enough. We're not going to put up with that.
Let's move beyond Chicago. Let's move beyond, again, values and attitudes and even politics. As you read the results, and again, keeping in mind you haven't nearly mined all the data that it provides you, but were there surprises for you where, again, you really begin to see shifts in direction in the attitudes and behaviors of Americans?
Very much so. This emphasis on international health.
Tell me more what you mean by international health.
We're concerned that the lack of positive health trends in other countries not only impact them, but impact us as well. The trend in American belief system has really gone from not beyond our borders to really understanding that we are a global village.
Has that happened as quickly as it feels like it's happened?
I don't think so. I think this has been a 20, 30-year build, and
really?
We're certainly not everyone believes that, but it is trending upward.
Are there other ways in which this globality is being expressed by Americans, where they're acknowledging in very specific ways that they are part of a larger universe, not just Americans?
Well, Chicagoans are very much, their concerns are extend across our own borders. They are more likely to actively engage in making life better for others. And what that means is that compared with the general population, we are concerned with the legacy that we are leaving for our children, and we believe that we can make a difference in the environment. That was a strong piece of data that we got, that we are much more environmentally focused than the coast.
That's a shock. In a city that where the recycling program
has been mediocre at best.
Okay, mediocre. We'll give it mediocre. That's a stretch. But I find that, I mean, there must be a lot of tension then in Chicagoans if they're really more environmentally concerned than those on the West Coast.
We believe that we can make a difference in global warming. Now, whether we're doing it or not is a different thing to discuss, but we believe that we can.
So we're beginning to see our interconnectedness.
Absolutely.
With the world. That's a bit of a surprise to me. So I would agree with you that is a surprise shift. Anything else that comes to mind that you saw in the survey data that you think is noteworthy?
In terms of the age breaks, it's starting to show that cuspers, who were born from 1955 to 1964, are starting to move into positions of influence and power. They're starting to feel like they can finally make a difference, and you're seeing that data trend up. Barack Obama was born in 1961, and many people in his administration, as he's starting to make appointments, are cuspers. So that group of folks who were so long overshadowed by the baby boomers are starting to believe that they can make a difference.
And do you see significant differences in the attitudes and behaviors of young adults?
Yes. 5 years ago, if you had asked me that, I would have said no. But the trend has been fairly significant in that they are understanding that the world has changed, sea change in the last year to 2 years, and what they can and can't do anymore. And there is a feeling of, again, frugal is the new green.
Very interesting results from the survey. Thanks for coming and sharing them with us today.
Thank you, Carol.
Wendy Taylor Nations is the managing director of the Chicago office of Porter Novelli. Finally, this week, we have Tim Halber. Tim is the managing editor of PlanEtizen that provides us with news each week. But this week, we're glad to have Tim on the show to tell us about his latest project, a children's book. What led you to do a book, Tim, a children's book on planning?
PlanEtizen's founding editor, Chris Steins, had become aware of a children's book from the 50s, 1952, called Neighbor Flapfoot, The City Planning Frog, by Bill Ewald Jr. and Merle Henriksen. And he got excited about this idea of republishing this book for a modern audience. So we got a copy of the book through eBay. It's hard to find, and it turned out to be a little dated for kids today. So we figured that what we would do is jump right in and write our own version of a book on urban planning for kids. And Chris's original inspiration for this was his twin boys, Grant and Rowan. He wanted to pass on to them his ideas of what urban planning is and give them an idea of what their dad does every day.
I know the feeling. Tell me the era that the earlier book was written in.
It was written in 1952.
Okay, 1952, that's a year I'm very familiar with.
And it had a very Dick and Jane sort of feel to it.
Well, I was wondering if it had a Dick and Jane feel.
Yeah.
So what was it that you had to update? I'm sort of curious. I mean, once you looked at the old book, tell me what you felt was inappropriate.
Well, it did have some ideas about zoning being the ultimate end-all for how city planning works, which today I know that zoning is one of those things that is a valuable tool to some people, and some people it's time to just get rid of it entirely, and it felt dated in that manner.
It always strikes me that most children, most adults for that matter, have no idea of the career options that exist. Do you think planning is one of those careers?
Absolutely, and I was going to say that's definitely another inspiration for the book. I myself didn't know about the career of urban planning until I was at least, I would say, in my early 30s. So it was a career change for me to go into planning. I know that people out there don't know about the field and what it does and its importance. So that was definitely a goal of the book, to get people early into understanding what the career is all about.
How do you interest kids in planning careers? I mean, what about a planning career would interest a child, would be compelling?
Well, I think one of the natural things that kids get attracted to about the idea of planning is building blocks. And that was something we grasped onto when we were getting ready to write the book, was that kids like to build. They have a natural inclination to line up elements and put them together and see how they fit. So when you look at a city as building blocks, that's how we sort of went naturally into this idea of the transect. The rural to urban transect, which was an idea created by Andreas Duany, basically takes a region and divides it up into 6 transect zones. Then you can break them down and say, okay, what elements go into each zone and what makes those areas attractive and what makes them so people want to live in this zone and what makes that zone unique. You know, Lego actually came out very recently with a set of blocks. It was the 50th anniversary, I think, of these blocks. It was a town set. And it looks suspiciously new urbanist today when you look at those blocks.
I was reading a dated article, one that came out just after the presidential election, and the author was interviewing one of Obama's top field staff organizer. And he was talking about how he hired people to work in the field offices. And he said, "I immediately eliminated anyone with a political science degree." And I thought, oh, well, that's interesting. So he was looking for a different kind of person with different sort of preparation to take those spots. And I'm curious if you think planners today are well prepared for the jobs they're being asked to do, or do they really need a different kind of training?
I think they are. As a, you know, a fairly recent graduate of a master's program, I believe that that urban planning school has, you know, taken a lot of changes over the years. And I think today there is definitely an emphasis on community engagement. And I think that is something that is very valuable for planners today, really getting in and working with the community rather than taking a top-down approach. So I would say yes, I think planners do have the tools coming out of school these days that they need. I would say if there is an issue, it would be the theoretical training versus the on-the-ground training and the sense of what real estate entails, the very hands-on and, I hesitate to say profit-oriented, but the side of development that is the money side.
That planners, would-be planners, are not getting enough education or training in that area.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. Makes it kind of hard to do their jobs without it, doesn't it?
Yeah. If you don't have that perspective, it becomes difficult to understand what developers want and what developers are looking for. Because many developers, in my experience, I've found, are mostly on the right side. They want to make their percentage of profit. And as long as they're going to make that, they're willing to do the right thing.
What's happening with the book now? Who's buying it? How's it being distributed? I'm just curious. What's the end goal here?
Sure. Well, in many ways, our end goal was to create the book and to have it out there for people to read. It is sort of a labor of love. We wanted to get people reading about it and learning about urban planning at a young age. Right now, we're selling it purely on our website, directly from planedison.com. I think you'll soon be able to purchase it on Amazon as well. Actually, we're doing a live reading of the book for kids at the Los Angeles County Natural History Museum January 25th. So we'd love it if people would come down.
Well, Tim, good luck with the book, and thanks for being with us on Smart City.
Thank you, Carol. It was a pleasure.
Tim Halber is the managing editor of PlanEdison. We have a link to the book, Where Things Are from Near to Far, on our website at smartcityradio.com. If you want to read the full report of the city dividends or navigate your way to the Porter Novelli report, you can go to our website, smartcityradio.com. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast, sign up for our weekly newsletter, or drop us a line and let us know how we're doing. Click on the contact button or send us email at questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, and national distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Additional support provided by National Trust Main Street Center, revitalizing America's traditional business districts to build sustainable communities. Visit www.mainstreet.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. He hopes he doesn't have to become president before he gets a dog. I'm Carol Coletta.